You're listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach in your context. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week we're very fortunate to have Carolyn Francis with us. Carolyn is co-pastor at Collins Street Baptist Church. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
And we're in Lent 3, third week of Lent. I want to get ahead of myself. And it's the woman at the well. The story that inspired the name of this podcast, actually.
Yes, so this is exciting. We've got three women here discussing the Samaritan woman in John 4.
Yeah. Exodus 17 we'll be touching on because clearly the living water appears in that one. But first of all, Carolyn, when I invited you here, this was a reading particularly that you gravitated towards, John 4. I'm wondering whether you can talk us through why that is.
So many reasons, but one is that one of the things that really energizes and animates my own faith and my ministry is this possibility for encounters which are truly transformative. Mm, mm. And this is a conversation between Jesus and an unexpected conversation partner, which turns out to be profoundly transformative. And to me, that offers us so much potential for understanding Jesus and this woman, but also for understanding the potential of our own faith mm. and the potential sacredness of our own encounters with one another.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I think it offers us a hopeful challenge in the church that we can continue to have conversations and continue to have personal encounters that are transformative.
And I think that's really fertile ground for preachers because our hope, I think, is that something that we say or something that people experience as a result of what we say will be transformative. And at the end of this story, I think if you're not changed in some way, you haven't perhaps been listening hard enough.
Yeah. And I also sense in there it's not just her, the woman who's transformed, it's all the people around her.
And potentially Jesus.
And
also,
I was going to say that, yeah.
Because there's something unexpected about this, I think, for him, certainly for the disciples and for the woman and then for her community. So it's a reminder, I think, that our encounters with the divine change everything if we allow it.
Yeah. Now, I think we'll go to the text. Yes. At this stage, there will be a moment where we do dispel some of the misunderstandings of these texts which have been around the church a bit too long.
Yeah, and probably the first of those is that this woman is a prostitute or somehow a loose
sexually
woman.
Loose, yeah.
Well, as soon as we hear five husbands, it sounds to us like that's the result of a set of really bad choices.
Yes.
Like she's the Elizabeth Taylor of the ancient world.
Or she's deeply tragic as well.
Yes.
You know, if they've all died.
But the reality for women is that the only way you can have five husbands is if five men have divorced you or died.
Or died, yeah. Yes.
Neither of which are impossibilities and which people, I think, in cultures different from our own understand more deeply than we do.
Yes.
But this is a story about sadness and loss and misfortune as much as it's a story about sin, more than it's a story about sin.
Yeah. That's right. And Jesus doesn't put the emphasis on, I mean, if we look at the five husbands comment, that's doing a different kind of work of revealing to the woman that there's something special about Jesus, that he kind of knows this random piece of information about her, not that he's judging her for it or making any kind of moral claim in that comment.
No, to the contrary, this potentially shameful information in no way stops this sacred encounter from occurring.
Yes.
So it's a message to us even now that the sources of our potential shame in no way inhibit our connections with one another or with Jesus or our ability to live and act on our faith.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, it's sometimes just worth noting what isn't in a text. So in that whole dialogue in the middle, and this is sort of verses 15, 16, 17, you know, about the husbands, in no way, there's no language of sin, there's no language of repentance or shame. It is, you know, you're speaking the truth and then the woman proclaims Jesus a prophet. You know, so, I mean, the very first thing, it's not that you spend your sermon dispelling myths, but
untruths, because myths means deep truth, remember?
Yes, thank you. Dispelling untruths or bad interpretations of the past, but let's not at least repeat them.
Indeed. And if we approach this as a kind of 21st century morality tale, we miss what it's really about.
Absolutely, yeah.
And for me, one of the really stark things right from the beginning is that Jesus is there because he is tired and he is thirsty. And so they're actually meeting one another as fellow travellers who are weary and thirsty. There's a sense of the human vulnerability of Jesus. There's a sense of his own frailty, which meets hers. And that's actually the beautiful thing that allows this entire conversation to take place. Mm. And to me, that reframes this completely.
Yeah. One of the, if I can just talk about the husband thing, I read a very interesting sermon by Craig Thompson. And I don't know how New Testament scholar will go with shifting this, but he talks about the marriage being a model in the Hebrew scriptures of the relationship between Israel and God, and that this is, and it's Baal, which means Lord or husband, and that here what's happening is the Baal could be an alternative God. Like, she's tried these other paths to life and been focused sort of like idols in a way. We all have them. Who are our five Baal? You know, who are our Baals? Like, really interesting sermon, and sort of an allegorical approach.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Quite interesting and very alternative to that morality tale stuff.
It really is. And however we understand that, we certainly have a sense that life has not been kind to this woman. Mm. She's at the well by herself. She's there
in the middle of midday, the day, which is
is not experiencing the warmth of community at this point.
Yes,
in time.
Normally we should say the women we would expect to travel together. You probably wouldn't go to the well in the middle of the day unless you really had to, because it's hot.
Too hot.
Mm. No, so there's something about her story that's left her isolated, and yet by the end of it, she's this great figure within her community. One of the great evangelists of the early faith. And somehow this encounter transforms not just her personal faith, but actually her role within the community.
Yeah.
And that speaks really deeply to me, because where we start with this sense that she's tragic or sad or unfortunate, we end up with her being a leader.
Yes. And there's huge promise and potential and hope, I think, in that, for me at least, that, again, it's one of the many, many biblical stories of God choosing and using unlikely people to spread God's word and to be agents of change and transformation in their communities.
Absolutely. And Jesus takes her so seriously. There's more words exchanged between them than between Jesus and anyone else in John's gospel.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so the substance of it says something to us.
I also think it's so significant it follows the encounter with Nicodemus, who comes hiding at night, not in the middle of the day, and who has all the worldly accoutrements that should enable him to understand and break it open, and he doesn't.
As an elite male who's educated.
Male, and,
yes, she couldn't be more different from Nicodemus.
No. Yeah, that's right.
And yet she grasps
the outcome is so
who
different.
Jesus is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe. We might problematize that a bit. But I want to come back to, Carolyn, the point you made about vulnerability and this meeting. I mean, there's a theme right there in the meeting of two vulnerable people potentially. Jesus tired, resting. He's in a not quite foreign land. That's probably too stark a contrast, but you know, he's in Samaria, so we haven't talked about the sort of
geography
and the cultural and religious tension in this text is that there's boundaries being crossed here. There's vulnerability for both, that is a man by himself and a woman by herself, they're talking to each other. That's breaking a whole lot of normal cultural assumptions about how genders mix. And then it's a Jew and a Samaritan. This is the only place where Jesus is explicitly called a Jew in the gospel, and it's to make the contrast that he's a Jew. Right. He's a real Jew. She's a Samaritan. And that's because there's hundreds of years of ancient tension and debate around worship and God and priestly practice between the Samaritans and the Jews of Judea.
So both groups considered themselves Jewish, I mean, as in the Samaritans did.
I think so, yes. Yeah. And it goes right back to post-exilic communities. And if you want a bit of the history, you go to 1 Kings 17. I think it's first, oh no, 2 Kings 17, checking my notes there, which kind of slags off on the
to put it colloquially.
Yeah. That's a theological term.
That's
isn't
a deep
it?
Theological term. You know, has a go at the Samaritans as being kind of what you were saying before, Fran, about other gods, as following other gods, breaking all the rules about who you choose as priests, and that they've really strayed from the faith. But that's rhetoric coming from one side.
Yeah, of so, course. But that does really help.
But I think it enhances the sense of vulnerability and that boundaries are being crossed and there's people who wouldn't normally be conversing here.
It's a risky encounter. It's risky for Jesus and it's risky for her. They both risk being profoundly misunderstood and the implications of that are serious. And he allows himself to be seen as tired and thirsty and in need of a drink from someone else, from an unlikely person. And for those of us preaching who might at times be tempted to think that we need to present ourselves as
totally
more
together,
than together
this
is a challenge to us, I think, because the encounter takes place because he asks her for a drink, because he stops, he's tired, and he asks for her help. And for those of us who are well-schooled in the mode of ministry, which is professional and competent and encouraged to be seen as such, this really challenges us to share our humanity, I think, with those to whom we speak and those we pastor and serve, and to be open to the possibility that that might be helpful and transformative and not actually a source of shame or embarrassment for us.
That's right. I mean, as you're saying that, it potentially invites conversation. I mean, I've seen that in colleagues, and I'm married to a priest in his ministry, is that it's often at the point where a Christian leader can admit a point of vulnerability or need or frailty that other people start to see the shared humanity and rich conversations and moments for sharing in faith
that
emerge.
That is absolutely my experience, but let's not pretend it's not risky.
No.
Or difficult.
Yep.
But it has potential, and it has potential for life and growth and transformation, which is at the heart of this passage and perhaps at the heart of what we're trying to do in ministry in general.
So there's so many images and themes we could unpack here. And one of the challenges of preaching a text like this is actually picking one and not perhaps attempting to do five things.
Yes, and if you're in ministry over a period of time, you will get to preach on this text several times, and it's okay for it not to touch on every aspect of the text in every sermon. And you might choose this encounter, you might choose to talk about the otherness of the woman and the meeting of difference. You might choose to talk about what living water is and the two kinds of water that are part
the
of this
literal and the
text.
Yeah.
You might choose to talk about how it is that her testimony transforms her entire community and what that looks like. But it would be unwise to try and do all of those things and your people would not thank you.
No, I don't think so.
No, I think I've heard a sermon simply on, it isn't.
No.
But God is spirit.
Yes.
What does that, that is in, that's three words in here.
Yeah.
And what does that mean in the 21st century, or is it meaningful? And
That's right. Can we unpack the water image a little bit? Because that is one of the themes this week. If you wanted to do something thematic that ties to the Exodus 17 reading, which is then also picked up in the psalm for this week. So if you're reading all of the, hearing all of those in scriptures, there's a theme there about the profound need for water. I mean, so at one level, this is a very human, physical need.
And in Australia at the moment, and I realise this will be listened to at several points, this podcast, but water has been utterly transformative over and extinguished bushfires.
Yes.
And just this morning on the news, I saw just the before and after, simply a week of, I forget where it was, but just arid.
Yeah.
These sheep on this arid land, a week later, it's all green.
Yeah.
So, and the joy. The joy that's on social media of children dancing in knee-deep
and
puddles.
And firefighters dancing when the rain came.
So they're extraordinary images. And, of course, this takes place somewhere where water is not readily available. You have to go to it.
It's not out of a tap.
It doesn't come to you. And so this promise of a never-ending source of
water. Living water.
An ongoing, this sense of the water that moves and flows and isn't just in this single place that one travels to, is an incredibly promising image.
And sort of unbelievable. And I don't mean that in not believing. I mean in extraordinary.
Yes.
And captivating.
Yeah, and it seems unlikely to a people who go to the well in the heat of the day that there would be a source of never-ending water, that one would never thirst again. And it ties to what Jesus says later also about food, where he tells his disciples that he has food they know nothing about. Mm. There's an underlying theme around what it looks like to be nourished.
Yes.
And what it's like to actually have a connection with the source of what will truly nourish you.
Yeah, for me it takes us in that, I mean, Jesus, and he does the same with worship in this passage too, takes it from the pragmatic, which is not to be dismissed, but to the deeper, profound spiritual question, which is not just that you're thirsty, but what are you actually thirsting for? What is your real thirst? And in Lent we often do this kind of fasting and other kind of practices to remind us of the season we're in. But it seems to me we can trivialize, those can be ways of actually trivializing the faith, like, oh, I gave up chocolate or I gave up coffee or like, well, great. But actually, if you're not doing the spiritual discernment of what are you really thirsting for and what are you, you know, spiritually yearning for and addressing that, the rest is just Band-Aids on open wounds.
I completely agree, because I think that the purposefulness of this season is to let go of some of what masquerades as truth or masquerades as nourishment in order to discover something that is more true or more nourishing. Yeah. And so we give up those penultimate things in our search for the ultimate things. And I think that's what is discovered in this interaction, that those things that we mistake for important turn out to be fleeting. And the things that we might miss, perhaps because we're not willing to be vulnerable or not willing to encounter someone or something different, those are the things that turn out to be rich and profound and might bring salvation if we want to be as bold
and
as that.
It seems to me in a world with as many messages coming to people in so many more ways than ever before in the history of the faith and humanity, that needs to be preached.
I agree. And this is actually a key purpose of preaching to me, that in a world in which we're bombarded with messages telling us what nourishment or salvation are, we are here to tell an alternate story, which is that these things that masquerade as life-giving are not real and that we are here to shepherd people a little and ourselves toward the deeper well of life. The things that bring life.
And in a sermon, you could actually select a couple of those. You could be quite pointed. For example, the self-care industry.
Yes.
Is that the place of life-giving water? You know, you could be quite pointed in a sermon in a series of ways to really ground it for people.
Yeah.
And then come and look at this other thing over here at the
and
well.
And then that the question that we never ever fully answer of what are you thirsty for or what are you hungry for and where might you go to discover it, is something you can encourage everyone to ask for themselves, I think. Yeah. And you don't need to answer it for them.
Yes, true.
No, that's
which
right.
Which is the other temptation in preaching, which is to say too much.
Yes. But to and then of course, you know, it goes beyond the sermon, which is not the point of this podcast, but that, you know, we have to add to that spaces in our church lives and in our faith communities where those conversations can continue and the spaces for discernment happen. I mean, the sermon is kind of the first step to kind of issue that call and that invitation.
Yes.
To come and meet the Jesus who in John's gospel is the source of all life. I mean, that's...
And for those of us privileged to preach in the context of an ongoing relationship with a congregation, we get to experience this ongoing dialogue where our preaching is just one input into a much broader conversation that is going on, partly including us, but also between our people and in their own lives. Yeah. And we're feeding that, but we're not the final word in that.
Yep. So we've touched on vulnerability and encounter of two unlikely people, this image of water and life and spiritual nourishment. It seems to me we have to talk about this woman's testimony and her role as really this agent, might seem a funny word, but, you know, she becomes the pivotal character in the transformation of a whole town who come and discover Jesus.
Which is extraordinary. She's the first evangelist in
John's
gospel, and she couldn't be a more unlikely person to fulfill that role.
And if you wanted the message believed, if you were strategic, you wouldn't have picked her.
No, I mean, there's every chance she could be dismissed.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's actually extraordinary that she wasn't.
Yeah, that's right. And that we have this story and we only have it here in John. So, I mean, it is a chance to preach this. We don't get it too often.
And I think it's an encouragement. I don't know, sometimes in our communities we're a bit reticent we've talked about this before, to talk about the faith with each other or particularly with people outside the faith. It's awkward sometimes.
It is. I mean, I grew up in the deep well of evangelicalism, and we used to practice our testimonies in youth group.
Yep.
And there are some downsides of that because it becomes quite pat and trite if you're not careful. But the upside of it is that I was always given a sense that faith was a gift to be shared. Mm. And some of us have done it very clumsily at different times and sometimes brutally, and that's nothing to be proud of. But I think there is a sense that if we hold a gift, then it is incumbent upon us to be open to the sharing of it.
Yeah, that's right.
I think what I find profound here is that, because I totally get what you're saying, is that she doesn't do it in that I know it all, I get it now. It's very provisional, but she knows something's there and wants to find out more, which is the inviting thing about it, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say in verse 29, so I think some of the feminist stuff I've read on this text and some of the attempt to recover her from poor translations, as we were talking about before, poor interpretations, has to make her this like instantly believing, amazing, you know, she got it in a second. And yet actually, and this is a kind of a Greek point in verse 29, when she goes to the rest of the town, she goes back to town, she says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. And the way the question is phrased in Greek, because depending which word for no you use indicates the answer you expect, she phrases it as, he can't be the Messiah, can he? And the answer we're prompted to come back with is no. That would be ridiculous. That would be absurd. She clearly believes, we've had a dialogue where she knows there's a Messiah to come. And so she's posing. And so, I mean, that's not in any way to diminish her. She's posing a question for which there's a real doubt, maybe even skepticism, like this can't possibly be true.
Well, we would do the same. We would do the same.
Would we?
In an encounter, I think so.
Maybe, yeah.
I think incredulity is a really valid response to Jesus.
Yeah.
And if we are never willing to express that that's how we experience
that, there
this
are
sometimes
absurd parts of
then
this story.
We're not being honest. And I think it's fascinating that her incredulity is not actually a barrier to other people finding faith. In fact, it seems to give her testimony strength, and maybe it's because it arouses so much curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I imagine makes people curious is that her persona has changed. She's gone from skulking around on her own to the well at high noon and goes out back to people with this message, this story to tell. And I get the impression that that's not who she was before.
Yes, there's wonder. She's engaging. She's suddenly talking to a whole crowd of people.
That's right. And it's not necessarily the content of her message, but how she has changed. Yeah. And I think sometimes we can get fixated on our content that we need to have slick, clever, or at least learned, solid answers, doctrines, our intellectual assent to these points of the faith. But actually, it's her person that has been transformed.
It is. And there's some in that skepticism, I think there's something deeply authentic too.
Yeah.
So like you're saying before, I mean, I also came from the kind of background in my youth of we would practice our testimonies and we would practice what you'd say to people. But the pat answers stop feeling authentic.
Yes.
And when we can acknowledge that, like, this has been life-changing for us, our faith is transformational, but we still have questions, there's still days we doubt, that we still haven't figured it all out, that's an authentic face to faith.
Yes, it is. And I think in our culture, that's as true as it has ever been, that actually people are quite skeptical of the too clean, the too slick.
The neat.
That's not our experience of life or spirituality, and it doesn't need to be what we project.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you might say, oh, it's not terribly important, Robin, but she leaves her jug at the well. Now, is that just a narrative device to suggest she's going to come back to the story, or is there something more about recognition that we still do need everyday water? Like, this is not some ethereal.
I think it could be a bit of both. It could be a narrative that she'll come back, but also symbolic of she's left the pragmatic jug because she's now found living water. Yeah. I think this John is all about symbolism, so inevitably something is.
Well, I'm presuming it's symbolic. Deliberate. That's all.
Yes, but I mean the other thing with her testimony that I couldn't help but note is she brings people to faith because they then come, you know, and the text tells us that many came to believe because of her. And then they meet Jesus and he teaches them, and then there's many more that come to believe. So, I mean, we've got some stages of kind of faith there in a way of her initial testimony brings people, but ultimately it is the teaching of Jesus that keeps them.
And this is another great reminder for preachers that our words are part of someone's story.
Yep. But
they don't have to answer every question. They don't have to bring everybody to faith. They are an input into a broader conversation.
Yep. And that's a response that's repeated in the scriptures, isn't it? The road to Emmaus, where some believed after that.
Yeah.
Some believed and some didn't. Some thought it was.
Well, yeah. And I think that's just the reality. I mean, we can be a bit overwhelmed in the church with the Acts 2 narrative of everyone hears and just instantly believes as if that's how ministry should always look. And it's just not.
It's not in my experience.
No, nor mine.
But, and also not on the pages in the New Testament. Jesus himself talked to people who walked away and did not believe.
Yes. But it on the other hand, offers this picture of the difference one person can make.
Yes.
The incredible significance of one person's testimony. And I think that in a world where the population is huge and people can have a serious experience of insignificance in life, this is actually a way of giving dignity to the human person. This woman whose life has been largely devoid of dignity, we get the feeling, suddenly has a role and it has an impact and she has significance and her gifts are seen and recognized and she makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's powerful for individuals, but for church communities in this big population who are often shrinking in number.
Yes.
And actually, to be salt, to pick up another image, you don't need much.
You do not need much, but you need truth and human honesty and
courage
and risk-taking,
vulnerability,
all of those things, which actually when the church is at the centre of culture don't come very naturally
to us. No, you don't
need
them.
No, that's right.
You don't need to be vulnerable.
There's some potential in this cultural moment.
I totally agree.
I think so. I think there's huge opportunity in this cultural moment for us to speak differently as Christians and authentically and all those words we've just used.
Yes.
And to remember too, I'm always struck, as you said, Carolyn, she's the first evangelist in this gospel. We don't know her name.
We do not
know. And the story goes on beyond any of us as individuals whose names, I mean, there's patriarchal reasons we don't know her name probably. But it is also a reminder that the story goes on beyond us.
And that's as the way it should be.
Yes.
In terms of the gift.
That's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the passage, what we're left with is that there is a group of people who call Jesus Saviour. And I'm pretty sure it's the only time Jesus is called Saviour in John before the resurrection.
Yeah.
And so there is a sense that what people gain from this is so much greater than what the initial interaction promised.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, we unfortunately have to leave it there because we are out of time already.
Already.
Thank you so much, Caroline, for joining us and bringing out the richness in this passage.
My great pleasure.
If you want to hear more from Caroline, you can go to Collins Street Baptist Church sometime.
We would love to see you.
Yeah.
11 a.m. worship. 10:30. Beg your pardon.
10:30.
Thank you for listening to By the Well. This podcast has been brought to you by the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College. Thank you for listening.